looky here, it's Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by eejournal.com. And hey, it's me, Amelia Dalton. This week, my friends, we're talking about shifting left, EDA-adjacent tools, virtual platforms, and testing of your embedded software. My guest this week is the one and only Simon Davidman, CEO of Empiris, and he's here to talk about all of that and more. Check it out.
My guest today is Simon Davidman from Empiris. Thank you so much for joining me today, Simon.
Thanks, Amelia. It's nice to see you again. Thanks for having me here.
So a quick refresher, what is Empiris all about?
What is Empiris all about? So Empiris, we're a tools company adjacent to the EDA space, where what we believe is that embedded software is getting very complex, especially as the software touches the hardware. And our whole focus is saying basically that nobody should be building embedded software if they don't simulate it. In the same way that no one builds a chip without simulating it, we don't believe anybody should be building software, writing software without simulating it. So Empiris is fundamentally, we have simulation technology, but simulation is just the beginning. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. So we believe there are these other tools and technologies that you need as well. And that's really what Empiris is about. It's a tool vendor that has simulation and tools for virtual platforms, as they're called, to help people develop better embedded software by using simulation.
So virtual platforms, let's talk about that, can be very useful in many different design situations. But let's talk about testing in particular. What do you see are the benefits of using virtual platforms to develop a verification and test environment?
Yeah, testing is a big challenge. And one of the things that has traditionally happened is as people develop software that runs on hardware, you know, they would port their operating systems and they'd get to a Linux prompt and they would be very happy. Oh, I've got the software to work. But actually, that's just really the beginning of the problem. And what we see is that traditionally people didn't test enough. They would get something to work and then they would hope that it met the goals. And what people can do with our technologies and with simulation is actually push their designs and their software into a variety of corners. So there can be simple tools like code coverage, there can be functional coverage, there can be assertion checking and everything. And so that people haven't traditionally done as much testing of the software as they would do with the hardware. And we believe that has to change. And obviously, the world's in a different place now with security issues and holes in things, the reliability, cars driving off roads and not braking and things like that. And that all comes down to what the quality of the software is. And I think that traditionally software hasn't been tested well enough in the embedded world. And part of that is because of the approach of using hardware. When you come to start using virtual platforms, there's a lot more you can do. For example, you can stimulate the design in different places quite easily and push the software into conditions that you could do randomly rather than think about. And you may stimulate it into strange places. And it's very interesting. So what's happening in, for example, in automotive, there's a standard DO26262, which one of its main parts of it is saying that the software in automotive has to become reliable and it has to survive being attacked by bit flips due to radiation and things. And the reason that's the case is if you think about chips, they're getting smaller and smaller, but actually their caches are getting bigger and the cache end up being just basically a solar panel. So when the rays are sitting at it, bits flip. And what they want to know in the automotive world is if these bits flips, does the software survive? And that's very hard to do when you've got hardware. But if you've got a simulation platform and virtual platforms like our technology, you can actually inject faults in it and check that the software still gets to the point. And you can test it in a way you could never do it in the real hardware. So that by using a virtual platform technology, you can actually get to the point where you're much more comfortable and assured that the quality that you've put in the software is going to achieve these goals of actually surviving and or detecting the fact that something's gone wrong in the system. So testing has become more important. And virtual platforms, we believe, with other technologies can provide a much better environment to getting the quality of software up and improving the testing. And one of the things that's happening that hasn't been productized yet that we've got actually some universities doing with our technology is doing what they call fault simulation, where they're using our virtual platforms at an instruction accurate level, they're injecting faults into it and then running it and seeing how well the software survives that. And they basically measure the results and say, okay, it was detected, it wasn't detected, there was no perceivable effect of it. And in that way, they can characterize how effective the software is at surviving these. And these aren't attacks, this is often to do with the sun radiation rays flipping bits in there. So there's a big issue of test embedded software, and we believe virtual platforms help. You need tools, though, and the world is changing in the tools space, and we believe that there's going to be areas like fault simulation going to come into that to actually provide better solutions.
So I saw Empiris just launched new models for the ARM Cortex-A72. So what kind of challenges and issues are solved by using virtual platforms for software development targeted at ARM-based devices?
The fundamental question, what is the purpose of this sort of virtual platform development and why do we have these models and everything, is when you're developing a design and if you're building a chip, you often don't actually see the chip for, 2 years after you start, for example. And the problem is when you get a chip that has a complex processor in it, like a 64-bit ARM, it's no use. You know, silicon without software is just sand. And if you can't have the software running on it when the chip comes out, people can't use it. So what you need to do is you need to start developing the software right at the beginning when you've got the chip architecture while you're doing that. And of course, if you make a decision, okay, we're going to use this processor from an ARM, an A72 or whatever it is, what you really want is to get a model of it on that day and have it, give it to your software team and have them start building software. So the benefit in having these models is that you can actually start at the same time that you're committing to develop the silicon, you can actually get the software developed. And so you basically, there's a term being used, shift left. You know, you can actually start the software at the same time as you're starting the RTL design and everything. So the benefit of having these models is you can get there earlier. That's basically why one of the things that we do, which we put a lot of emphasis on in Empiris, is that we will build models of the sophisticated parts when they become available as public specifications. So ARM, announced their A72, it becomes public, we then have an agreement, we build this model, and we make it available to people. The key benefit is they can get the software running way sooner than they could if they have to wait for hardware prototypes.
So you guys offer a variety of extendable platform kits. So are they the same as virtual platforms or models? Or what do they include?
That's a good question. Traditionally people would build their own platforms or contract a vendor such as us to build the platforms. And what we found is that was a business we didn't really want to do. We do not want to be a service business. We don't think that scales. We have partners that do that. But the customers don't want to do it either. And so it's a sort of chicken and egg a little bit. And so what we came up with the idea is, we will build platforms of sort of standard designs, whether it's a MIPS Malta or it's an ARM Versatile Express or a foundation model. And we will build a model of that in such a way that it's extendable. So we build it so it runs the different OSs. We provide it onto the website so people can download it and just use it out of the box, just like they'd buy a board and they can start using it. But it's extendable because we provide the source of it. Because typically a customer doesn't want that board. What they want is that's a development board. They want their chip, their design, their board, which has most of those bits on it, but four or five other bits. So what we have is it's an extendable platform kit that we make available, and we have some 20 of these available, where you get the source of it, it comes, you can use it as it is, they run with Linux, they've got all that stuff on it, but if you've got your own component, you can model that and plug it in. And so that the extendable platform kit allows you, just like having the processor model, that you don't have to do it, you can start immediately with the extendable platform kit, with typically an operating system like Linux or FreeRTOS or something running on it, and it allows you to get started with your development process very early on without a lot of wait for the model to be built. Now, often you do have your own components, your behavioral components that you will need to build, and so you will need to get those built by us or yourself or a third party. But typically they are not as complex as a main processor or maybe Ethernet or USB, so it's a relatively easy job to do. So the idea of the extendable platform kit is it's an off-the-shelf component that you can use and you can extend and modify and change it to represent your design. So it allows you to get started very quickly, and it really is just a virtual platform. A CPU model is a model that will run in a virtual platform. An extendable platform kit is a virtual platform, but it's a normally model to target a specific real board. And if you want to build an ARM system or a MIPS system, you'll go to them. They'll say, well, we've got this board, that board, or this board. They'll have FPGAs on them. They can put processors on them and stuff like that. What you do is you then would want to modify that and add your things to it. And that's how it's done with the breadboard. These extendable platform kits are exactly the same, but they are just simulation models or virtual platforms, but they're targeted to be the same functionality as an existing part. It could be an SoC, it could be an FPGA-based system, or it could be an existing board.
All right, Simon, it's time for your off-the-cuff question. Now, last time you were on my show, you were preparing for your 1,000-mile bike race, or journey, rather. You completed it. How did you do? And what were your biggest challenges in your 1,000 miles?
I'm not sure how honest I'll be with some of this, but yeah, you say race or journey, and it's funny. you got to think that I did some 3,000 miles of training for this. And when it comes to it, it does feel like a bit of a race. You want to keep up with the guy in front or whatever. But it really wasn't a race. There was 11 of us did it from the north of Scotland to the south of England for a charity. And, you know, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of hard work. I think I probably trained too much. And we were unbelievably lucky with the weather. Going north of Scotland, it could have been horrific. And I think it was September, so it can rain all the time and be pretty windy. And actually, we were going south, and the wind tends to go towards you. And so that could have been terrible. But as it was, it drizzled and rained on the first day. And apart from that, it was just fantastic the whole time. So, you know, I had a good time. I completed it. I really enjoyed it. People were surprised that every night I'd get exhausted to the hotel and I'd write a blog up for the people that had funded me and helped raise things. So every day they could see pictures, and I tried to do 10 pictures a day and write, you know, a couple of pages of text. And some days I didn't. And it was fun. I mean, it was a good experience. I mean, and actually the worst thing was, I mean, apart from all the creams you had to worry about and the nutrition and food and stuff like that, because you're eating stuff, is that you get very tired. And a lot of the places we stayed to didn't have baths. And, you know, if you've cycled all day, you want to lie in a hot bath, a hot tub, and just relax. And a couple of times, you know, there I was squeezed in the corner of a shower tub with a drizzle, because England doesn't do showers very well. And that was, maybe I shouldn't share this, but that wasn't, you know, that was one of the hardest bits, actually, is that it was sometimes not easy to get relaxed in the evening. It was a bit stressy sometimes, but it was fantastic. It was a fantastic journey. I had never done anything like it. I did it very well. I feel a lot better from it. It was great to help people raising the money, and I thanked all the people that helped me raise money, and I had a great time. Thank you. And I'm not sure I'll ever do it again, but
that was going to be my follow-up question. Well, Simon, it was always a pleasure having you on my show. Thank you so much for joining me.
Great. Thanks very much, Amelia. Thank you.
So have you heard about Swarm? And no, it has nothing at all to do with Pokemon Go. Now, I would have labeled this segment news you may have missed, like other episodes of Fish Fry, but revolutions you may have missed seemed a bit more appropriate. So, those intrepid engineers over at MIT have found a way to make multi-core a whole lot more multi. Let me introduce you to Swarm, a whole new way to design chips that should make parallel programs way more efficient and easier to write, too. How exactly? Well, the buzz about Swarm is, get it? The buzz? But anyway, is how it deals with tasks, specifically the synchronization and prioritization of tasks. This new 64-bit chip architecture, developed by Professor Daniel Sanchez and his team at MIT, actually includes specialized circuitry for executing and prioritizing tasks. So, standard multi-core systems must explicitly divide the work that we're doing into tasks, right? And balance the synchronization between tasks accessing shared data. Well, Swarm actually removes all sorts of explicit synchronization. It also timestamps tasks according to their priorities and begins working on the highest priority tasks in parallel. Higher priority tasks may also have their own lower priority tasks, but Swarm slots those into its queue of tasks automatically. Now, an important part of this puzzle is that extra circuitry that Swarm has in order to store and manage its queue of tasks. Swarm also includes a circuit that records the memory addresses of all the data that the cores are currently working on. In that circuit is contained something called a bloom filter, which, in essence, shoves all of the data into a fixed allotment of space and answers yes or no questions about its contents. So it's this bloom filter that's crucial to Swarm's ability to identify memory access conflicts. This team of researchers at MIT were also able to show that enforcing synchronization between its cores was much easier with the addition of timestamping. Okay, so for instance, each data item is labeled with a timestamp of the last task that updated it. So tasks with later timestamps know that they can read that data without bothering to determine who else is using it. Okay, so another piece of this swarm puzzle is called transactional memory, which is a mechanism to make sure that multiple processors working in parallel don't step on each other's toes. Transactional memory makes sure that updates to shared memory locations occur in an orderly manner. So, for the parallelization of tasks, a related technique is used called thread-level speculation, and it's used specifically for transactional memory functions. So, as they say, the devil is in the details. What kind of details, results, are we looking at here? Well, this team at MIT compared a same set of algorithms on some standard chip architectures and swarm. And get this, the swarm versions ran between 3 and 18 times faster and required, get this, 1/10 as much code or even less. And in one particular test case, Swarm achieved a 75-fold speedup on a program that this team at MIT had so far failed to parallelize. Folks, I could talk all day about this new Swarm architecture, but if you want to find out more details about this new MIT project, including how exactly it will make our software lives easier as well, I've included a couple links on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com, including a white paper entitled Unlocking Ordered Parallelism with the Swarm Architecture. Oh yeah, good stuff. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And if Google Plus is your thing, you can also join our circle on Google Plus. We also have a YouTube channel, keyword, EEJournal, chock full of all kinds of techie videos, our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series, and our video series called On the Scene. And you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. I'm just saying. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can also grab our Fish Frying RSS feed or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or the best geeky hotspot in your city, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of July 15th, 2016, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.